This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Hi there. My name's Amita Kirpalani, and welcome to the Wheeler Centre for a conversation with Kate Cole Adams and Kate Leslie tonight. I'd like to acknowledge that we meet here on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and I'd also like to put forward that for me an acknowledgement of country is about the fact that this was and always will be traditional Aboriginal land. Kate Cole Adams's book, Anesthesia, The Gift of Oblivion, The Mystery of Consciousness, is the subject of our conversation tonight. So Kate is a journalist, and her first novel, Walking to the Moon, was published also by Text in 2009. So Kate Cole Adams is in the middle, and Kate Leslie is on the other side of me. I will be using your full names, I'm sorry, the whole night. But it'll be obvious, I hope, who I'm
You could always just call me KCA.
That's too hip-hop for me, I'm okay. Sorry. Fair enough. Kate Leslie, Professor Kate Leslie, is a specialist anaesthetist and head of anaesthesia research at the Royal Melbourne Hospital. She's a professorial fellow at the University of Melbourne and Melbourne University, so please help me welcome them to the stage. It feels quite special to have them both on stage together, your mind tonight, because Kate Cole Adams interviewed Kate Leslie for the book, and you feature in the book as well. And that is because, as some of you may know, Kate Leslie and her research partner, Paul Miles, I like to think of you as the Beyonce and Jay-Z of the anaesthesia research world. But we will get to that in a minute. And I also should say that we do a lot of talks at the Wheeler Centre, as most of you will know, and I really elbowed my way into this interview seat because I am absolutely in love with this book and totally fascinated by what you both do and think about. So I'm going to throw to the biggest question I could possibly think of to start with, just to start in chaos. And I want to ask you both, what is unconsciousness and what can it tell us about consciousness? Now, before you answer, punch my mic out of the way, I want to say that let's return to this as we go along. Let's start out wide and then return to it.
I might... I don't actually have an answer, but I'll give you an answer of sorts. You know, the question, what is unconsciousness and what can it tell us about consciousness? It sounds so lovely and neat and kind of nicely wrapped up, and I feel like I should have that answer, but really all I can say is that we don't know what unconsciousness is really. I mean, you ask, or at least different people have different versions of what it is. You know, you ask an anaesthetist what it is, you ask a psychiatrist what it is, you ask a doctor what it is, you'll get
you
different...
You ask a journalist what it
is. You ask a journalist what it is, you'll get a lot of confusion, but you'll get different answers from everyone, and I suspect within each of those categories you're also going to have different answers. So what's unconsciousness? It's what consciousness isn't. What's consciousness? Well, no one can agree. You know, we don't know. I mean, there's been a huge amount of research in the last couple of decades, and, you know, we're closer to having a sense of what happens in the brain, but we don't really know what consciousness is. So to me, the sort of question, and this is one of the things that fascinated me you know, kind of tumbling into this book that I then kind of spent a decade or more in, was kind of going, well, if we don't know what unconsciousness is and we don't know what consciousness is, I mean, A, it interests me how you do your job, but we'll get on to that. But I guess for me, and without sort of being flip about it, it seems to me that it's not an easy question, there's not an easy answer. And to me, the most interesting parts of that answer are in the kind of space between what is clearly conscious and what we would say is clearly unconscious. And one of the things that surprised me in the research was how much grey there is in between the two.
So, Kate Leslie, how does that resonate for you, the space between that being a kind of definition for consciousness?
It resonates quite well. I mean, there are two key features, scientifically speaking, about consciousness. One is that the person is awake, so they appear to be not asleep, they're awake. And the second thing is that they have a sense of self, so they have a feeling that they are a person. So that immediately gets you into a discussion about when a new life becomes conscious. You know, are babies conscious in utero? You know, or when in development babies become conscious? And whether, you know, people at the other end of life with dementing illnesses are conscious if they're awake, but they've sort of lost the, you know, that sense of self. And then there are other states like dreaming. So clearly when you're dreaming, you're asleep, but you still have a sense of self because all dreams are dreamt in the first person. So is that something different? And then there's a sort of, you know, friends of mine can meditate and can transport themselves to, you know, different universes, you know, doing that type of work. And they're not in a completely conscious state as we would believe it either.
I'm interested in, we'll return to this, of course, we can't not. But I'm interested, I feel like everyone has a story about anaesthesia, and I'm interested in asking both of you, this is, as you say, a life's work, the book, to some extent. It's been in rolling around in your mind for so long, and you've been spent 13 years researching.
Look, I did the first interview for it in 1999, so it's been a while.
A while. Yeah. And I'm interested if you, do you have a story about what drew you to this area of medicine and why you've stayed there?
Well, I liked it because when I was a young doctor, I liked the team atmosphere in the operating suite. And so it wasn't, you weren't just sort of sitting in an office, you know, with just you and the patient. There were a bunch of people around. But I also liked the, I'm a woman of action. I like, you know, you draw up the drugs, you get everyone, you put the person to sleep, you do the operation, you know. And I like dealing with crises and dealing with difficult situations. And I also like that this bit about it, doing research on it, because there's so much that we don't know about what's going on while people are asleep.
I'm interested that, Kate Cole-Adams, you're an anaesthetist. They've returned in your work numerous times, the husband of the protagonist in your novel. And so I'm interested, what drew you there initially?
Yeah, look, it's an interesting question. And you know, again, I'm just going to spend a lot of tonight saying, look, I don't really know. But, you know, when people ask me, well, why did you, you know, a sort of, you know, a sociology major who failed maths decide to spend, you know, 15 or so years of your life investigating anaesthesia?
It's a cool club, the Failing Maths Club.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I've got about three different answers, and the first answer was that in 1999 I met a woman who'd had the experience of waking under anaesthesia, and it was the sort of the full kind of the full nightmare scenario. Mm. She'd gone in for a Caesar, and she woke on the operating table, fully conscious, fully paralysed, and in enormous pain. And I talk about that story in my book, and I also talk about, she's an amazing woman, her name's Rachel Benmayer, and one of the things that fascinated me was what she actually did with that experience, and also what happened to her mind during that experience. But I sort of realised relatively recently that actually I'd been preoccupied in this area for much longer, and I'd kind of done, you know, I'd done feature stories on coma and locked-in syndrome and sort of unconscious, sort of the ways of the body unconsciously signalling distress. And I'd written a novel that was about a woman who'd just woken up from a coma who was married to an anaesthetist. So clearly there is something going on in my kind of, you know, I would say still fairly unconscious processing. Yeah, and I was going to say something else that had struck me about that also was that when I, you know, when I... Actually, I might get back to that later.
I'll allow it.
Huh?
I'll allow it.
Okay, good.
I'm interested that you don't mention the work of your grandfather here.
That was
and
what
you never
I was thinking
do.
Of mentioning. Yeah.
I want you to talk about it if you won't mind.
Okay, all right, I will. No, I really do. I mean, I sort of find there's so many things in this book that it's like, well, which bit to pull out? And It was only, I mean, you know, when we had that conversation the other day and you asked about my grandfather and I said, oh, yeah, I never even talk about him. But one of the, you know, one of the things that really interests me in the whole conversation about anaesthesia really, and, you know, I'm not a scientist, I don't understand how it works. You know, I spent years interviewing people and looking at them thinking, I really have no idea what you're talking about. But part of my job as a journalist was to try and make that into something that made some sense. But I'm very interested in the idea in thinking about what people actually take, what we as individuals take with us into an anaesthetic, and the fact that we're not just a patient, that we're an individual and we have our we bring to each anaesthetic our own psychology, our own personal history, our own culture. And also increasingly, as I wrote, it really sort of struck me that we also bring our kind of antecedents, we bring our genetic inheritance, we bring the sort of people we are and the sort of people our family are, and all of these things kind of make a difference in terms of how, I mean, it makes a practical difference, which you know obviously more about than I do, but in my understanding is in how people actually respond to an anaesthetic. But, sorry, that was a very long prelude. Just when I was researching the book, and really right towards the end, when I was kind of scrambling to sort of, you know, I had a proper deadline at that point, and I opened up a cupboard that I had, I knew was there, and there was a manuscript in there that I knew was there, but that I had not looked, I didn't remember looking at at all, but when I opened it, it was my mother's father, my grandfather's manuscript, and it was his effort. It was basically a book that he had spent probably 15 years of his life working on, an unfinished book, which was all about consciousness. So, yeah.
And you detail some of that so beautifully in the book, and his description of thwartings, I really remember.
Yeah, it was very uncanny, and it was very, I sort of felt quite emotional about it really, because reading his book, he seemed so familiar to me, and I kept on thinking, oh, you poor bugger, you've spent all this time on this book. Oh, this must be doing your head in. And then he died young, so he never got to finish the book. So I kind of, yeah, I really liked pulling a bit of him in as well.
You mentioned during that description what occurs to... There's a question about what occurs to the body and the mind under anaesthetic. And I thought, because we have Kate here today, would you be willing to step us through that process and also the conversation that you have with the patient once they're on the table?
Well, we normally meet the patient before they get put on the slab.
The slab.
And we talk to them about their health and what we're planning to do and what their expectations are and so forth. And increasingly, we're teaching our young trainees to really get more into finding out what people want and seeing if those wants can be met. So when we pop you on the operating table, we attach all the monitors up to you, and then we usually give you a pain-killing drug. And so you start to feel a bit woozy, and that's a drug, it's like heroin. It's morphine or fentanyl. And then we slowly give you the propofol, which is the drug that we use to put you off to sleep. And it's not sleep, I should say that. And the president of the college, David Scott, will be very cross with me for using the word sleep. But we use the word sleep because it's comforting and people understand it. But anaesthesia is completely different from sleep. Anyway, so normally you'll feel a burning pain up your arm from the propofol.
That's comforting. Comforting.
And not very usually. We can do things about that, but the that's the drug that was that killed Michael Jackson, propofol. But if you have a highly qualified anaesthetist like like me giving you that drug, then you, that's much better. And then we don't do the count to 10 thing anymore. We usually just try and chat to you about something nice and then off you go, and it's the most lovely feeling, or that's what a lot of people think. Other people don't like it. They feel like they're falling into a black hole of, what risk and fear and so forth. But we try to get over that. Then after you're asleep, we pop something in your mouth to help you breathe, And we might put that further down your throat with the use of a drug that keeps you still. And those drugs were first came from South American arrow poison. They're curare drugs. And it was those drugs that actually led to a sort of an epidemic of awareness in the middle of the 20th century.
Mm, which Kate details in the book in detail. Yeah, amazing detail.
Yeah, so essentially these drugs do three things. They make you lose, they make you become not awake. You are unconscious. They make you make encoding new memories usually impossible or very difficult. And they do other things like affect the cardiovascular or the heart system and the lung system and so forth. But it's very interesting that they don't disrupt everything. So they're quite specific. And why they are like that is not known and is an area of a lot of research. So in the sort of getting into the kind of, you know, creepy metaphysical stuff that we love, it's uncertain whether, you know, your sense of self or your real identity or your soul or whatever is anaesthetized along with those other bits of your brain.
Mm.
Because lots of the networks in the brain are still keeping your body ticking over, you're renewing all your cells and you're getting older, unfortunately. And so that's what's happening while you're asleep. And then at the end, we turn everything off and reverse drugs with various antidotes and you wake up. And sometimes people remember the things that we've got in their mouth being there as we take them out. Most of the time they don't remember that. So most people wake up in the recovery room under a nice warm blanket with a, you know, highly skilled, kind recovery nurse, of whom there are many in the audience, you know, looking after them and then go off to recover, you know, get on with recovering.
I'm interested in what you found is a really big fear that patients have when they meet you initially. What are they worried about, and do you think that's justified or...?
Well, most of the patients are concerned about the outcome of the surgery. And, you know, most patients don't really know much about their role at the anaesthetist or the anaesthetic nurse who's helping the anaesthetist or the other people in the operating theatre, what their roles are. So then most people are rightly concerned about how the operation will go. And then some people are concerned about the anaesthetic. People don't seem to worry so much about not waking up, but they want to wake up with all their faculties intact. They don't want to lose marbles in the operating theatre, and they don't want to have a heart attack or a stroke, or if they're me, they don't want to vomit afterwards.
It's a bad look. I want to ask both of you about, Kate, you've done a huge amount of research for the book about anaesthetic awareness and in lots of ways, the book revolves around the instances which are not so high. And Kate, Leslie, you just mentioned that. I think it's 1 to 2 in 1,000. Is that right?
Yeah. Look, I mean, it really depends. There's various different ways of measuring, but sort of big studies similar to what you and Paul did, although you were doing it with all higher risk patients. But sort of big studies where you actually wake people up and then you give them questions. It tends to be 1 or 2 in 1,000 recall something of the operation, but it would be a much smaller percentage who actually would have an experience like Rachel Benmayer's.
Mm. Do you want to describe that, or perhaps the Hank Bennett account of the black stuff as a way to kind of describe how anaesthetic awareness manifests?
Well, I mean. It's interesting because I mean there's so many different ways that you can be aware, in the same way that there's so many different ways that you can be conscious. And you know, one of the things that's really struck me really since doing the book, while I was doing the book, but also since, is the number of people. I've been on radio quite a lot, and every time I do a radio slot, at the end of that slot, the switchboard is completely full of people who are ringing up, and they've got stories to tell. And on the whole, they've got stories to tell about, you know, most of them are not very happy experiences. And occasionally, and, you know, and I've had a couple of really, really heartbreaking letters and emails, you know, particularly from women who like Rachel, had cesareans. I mean, there's some procedures where, because of the procedure, you're at higher risk because you can't be given as much anaesthetic. And one of those is cesareans because you don't want the drugs to go through to the baby. But, you know, I've had a couple of women who, from the 80s, with horrendous experiences and sort of describing, you know, kind of not only the sort of agony and the waking, but I mean the powerlessness is really profound, and that's what actually really creates the PTSD, which is very common in these situations. But also there've been a you know, far more sort of less sort of dramatic examples, and you know, I kind of. And there was one recently, and this woman sent me this lovely card, which was sort of saying, thank you, thank you, thank you. And she was saying, oh, look, you know, I was really confused about my surgical experience recently, and I felt really kind of crap. And I, you know, and I went, and I've been seeing a psychologist, and she's not helping, and your books really helped me make sense of what happened. But when I actually asked her more about what had happened, the odd thing was that she had actually been aware. She was having a pacemaker inserted, and heart surgery is another one where, you know, awareness is a bit more common. So she had actually woken during that surgery. She'd been in pain. She'd heard what was happening. But that wasn't what was really troubling her. What was troubling her was the conversation she'd had with her surgeon beforehand and her feeling that he hadn't listened to her concerns and that she'd been pushed into the surgery faster than she was ready. But she said she was so anxious about it that when they left the operating room just before they were about to begin, she actually tried to get off the table. And she said that when she woke up, they kept on telling her that she'd needed five times more anaesthetic than normal. Now, I don't know, Kate, is that a thing? Is that...
It is a thing.
That's the technical term, yeah.
What you've described is one of the biggest problems that we as a profession and as professionals have with this issue, which is that pacemaker insertion is usually done under local with sedation. So the first step is to make sure that the patient understands that that's what's going to happen.
Oh, okay. Right. So she wouldn't have actually been under a
general. Other big procedure that where we run into this trouble is colonoscopy. So people think they're going to have a general anaesthetic, or that they won't remember anything, and then when they do remember something, they think they've been aware. So there's all these different experiences on a continuum of remembering just a tiny little bit and not really caring about it to having a really distressing experience like Rachel did. Mm. And the main thing is to, for us as anaesthetists, to make sure that patients understand what is supposed to be happening.
Because I was just going to say really quickly, one of the things that really struck me, and there was some quite recent research, which was that George Mashour, they discovered the same thing, that they were talking to people who had supposedly sort of been, you know, woken under anaesthetic, and they discovered that actually quite a lot of them had never been meant to be fully anaesthetised anyway. They were basically being deeply sedated, but they hadn't understood what would happen. However, the translation from their experience to PTSD was almost identical to if they'd actually woken under in the middle of the surgery. And so, you know, one of the things that struck me is, well, from the patient's perspective, it makes no difference. Mm. You know, what you're left with is an experience of powerlessness and terror. And, you know, and the thing about those sedative drugs is they're disassociative too, so you start feeling a bit wacky and people can get really, really scared, and it's the fear, you know. And one of the things that interested me was that actually, although obviously in extreme cases where people really can feel everything, it's kind of like torture, and, you know, it's just like... You don't want your plane to fall out of the sky. You don't want that to happen to you. Occasionally, they do, but the real, you know, people can actually put up with some pain. It's not as much of an issue as feeling completely bewildered and completely powerless, which is why these conversations I think are really important, because you know, from my perspective, it's really important that people have an idea that this sort of thing can happen, because simply discussing it actually means that your outcome may well be much better. I mean, that's my perspective. Does that...
You're absolutely correct. Yeah.
Good. Dr. Kate.
Professor Kate.
Professors Kate. That made me think of the fact that Kate Cole Adams, you told me, Kate Leslie, you speak right through the surgery to the patient the whole time. And that the,
don't speak to them continuously, well, or the surgeon again.
It's not just we are
annoyed. I do talk to the patients that are under my care, especially when I think they might be a bit too lightly anaesthetised. And, you know, and particularly sometimes in the middle of the case we have to manipulate the things that we've got down their throat or whatever, and that's very, very stimulating. So I usually say I'm just fiddling with the thing in your mouth, it's all going well, and tell a few fibs like, operation's nearly over, you know. But I had a great an experience like that, which has actually been published, so I can say it without, you know, invading anyone's privacy. We were doing a research project about dreaming under anaesthesia, and we had a patient, and I was actually, was on my list. So towards the end of the operation, the senior surgeon handed the instruments to the junior surgeon and left, which is, for the anaesthetists in the room, a time when your heart sinks. And then... So I'd mistimed the end of the anaesthetic a bit, and the patient started wriggling around. So I said, "Don't worry, you know her name. Everything's okay." And I gave her a shot of propofol, and she instantly, her BIS value went. This is an EEG thing, went like way down, and she was deeply anaesthetized. And so my research nurses interviewed her afterwards, and she said, "Oh yes, I had a dream. I was going along the road in a fast car, I think it might have been an ambulance, and then all of a sudden the road opened up in front of me and the car sped and went into the hole, the black hole in the ground, and I heard you say, 'Don't worry, everything will be okay.'" And I said, "What a fascinating dream." And then a couple of hours later she didn't remember it. So the question, the ethical question, is whether I should have told her that she was awake or not.
Yeah, that is an interesting question. Did you? Yeah.
No.
No.
You know, what goes on tour stays on tour, I think.
Kate, you described plenty of studies where there's a kind of ethical quandary at the heart of them. Are there any that come to mind that you'd like to talk to?
Well, there are several. There's a really kind of, I say famous, and the reality is, because it's got to do with anaesthetics, it's not really famous, because as far as I can work out, no one knows anything about anaesthetists or anaesthetics. It's like this kind of blank spot. And in fact, the most famous anaesthetist in the world, who's in this book and who Kate also has met, died recently, and there was this kind of galvanising silence. It was like, okay. I've forgotten your question, sorry.
Well, I'm interested in some of the studies that you talk to in the book.
One of the kind of the sort of seminal study was done by a guy called Bernard Levinson, who was a youngish South African psychiatrist, and he decided, he was very fascinated. It was the 60s, and he was very interested in the whole idea of unconscious processing and this idea that maybe you could hear and take in information while you were anaesthetised. So it being the 60s. He basically, you know, sort of buddied up to a dental surgeon who said, sure, I'll stage a fake crisis among my unwitting, surgical patients tomorrow. And they did that. And halfway through these guys' surgeries, they were under anaesthetic. Suddenly the anaesthetist stopped and said, I don't like the... Hold on, I don't like the patient's colour. The patient's looking very blue. General consternation, quickly let's blow the breathing bag, sounds of breathing bag. And then, oh no, look, everything's terrific now, they're doing really well, drama over. And when the patients woke up, You know, they asked them how everything was. It was all fine. Do you remember anything? No. And then a month later, Bernard Levinson interviews them in his rooms in Johannesburg, and he hypnotises them. He sort of hypnotically regresses them, and hypnosis is a whole other thing, and has weird parallels to anaesthesia. But under hypnosis, half of them actually remembered verbatim parts of the crisis, the fake crisis. So that kind of raised all sorts of interesting questions, and it was a very flawed study in various ways. But it kind of, there have been quite a few studies since then looking at this kind of phenomenon and wondering whether people can actually, you know, these aren't, you know, like the experiences we've been talking about up until now when people actually wake. I mean, that's not actually an anaesthetic, that's a failed anaesthetic. But there's really, and I find this so fascinating, that sort of whole area where it's like, well, yeah, but if you're properly anaesthetised, can you take in information? And there've been quite a few, all admittedly quite small studies, but that have shown that yes, you can, but they can't test anymore like they did. They can't stage fake crises anymore because it would be unethical. Mm. So now they kind of tend to say really boring things like, you know, you'll be unconscious and they'll sort of just say apple pear or, you know, what is the blood pressure of the octopus or kind of stuff like that, which, you know, why would you necessarily remember that anyway? But there's a guy called Hank Bennett who I met in 2004 when I kind of almost accidentally landed in a very strange anaesthesia conference in Hull in northern England. And he'd done something. He's a bit wacky, but he's
a lot of the people in this area are.
But
a bit
I
wacky.
Knew you were going to say that. But he's not.
They're not.
He's,
they're
he's,
not.
Well, his interest. He's a very intense person. He's quite an emotional person. But he had done some really interesting studies. And you know, one of these studies was he got people when they're anaesthetised and just sort of towards the end of the operation, he kind of whispered in their ears, you know, when you wake up, I want you to, I want you, this is very important that you remember what I tell you. And what I would like you to do is when I speak to you next time or whatever, I want you to let me know that you've heard me now by touching your ear. I think it was his ear. And he had a theory that actually the sort of learning that might happen during anaesthesia might not be verbal, it might not be the sort of learning that we're familiar with, but that actually there might be kind of non-verbal memories. And, you know, and sure enough, that was the outcome of that study.
Yet, and do we count that as a hypnosis?
Was that a hypnotic...
Do we consider that Hank Bennett was performing a kind of hypnosis on the patient, or is that a whole different game?
I actually can't remember what his interview... whether his interview was hypnotic... I think it was a hypnotic regression. Yeah, mm. It was. It was. I mean, the whole hypnosis question is just so bizarre. But, I mean, you can actually do an entire... You can do surgery just under hypnosis. Have you tried that?
No. No.
But I mean, I'm not a believer.
But you're not a believer
because it happens. Or not a believer in actually doing it in your operating theatre.
Yeah. I'm interested you say this, Kate, because in my mind, the speaking to the patient, not constantly, but throughout the surgery. I read that in the book as a... I mean, hypnosis might be a dirty word to you, but...
It's not a dirty word.
But I read it a little like that, but you don't consider it similar.
I'm talking to the patients because... for two reasons. One, as a leader in the operating room, I want everyone to treat the patients as a person while they're having their operation. But secondly, just in case they actually are retaining things that they will remember later. So there's no doubt that touch and sound and pain and taste and sight and hearing, they all go in. It's all getting into the brainstem, the primitive part of the brain, but it's not getting anywhere else and it's not being consolidated into a memory that you'll have later on.
Because you mentioned the memory blockers that occur.
Yes. So there's lots of small studies, and some of them I have done myself, and I think the jury is out about whether you can learn under adequate anaesthesia. And I suspect that you can't, but I'm hedging my bets.
Mm. And, yeah. And also, how can you tell whether someone is always under it? How do you know if someone is adequately anaesthetised in any moment? And I know, sorry, Amita, but no. the you know, when I met Kate, you were doing this kind of amazing study, you know, the superstar study with or the study that kind of turned you and Paul into Jay-Z and Beyonce. But which was basically a kind of doing a sort of testing this new, and I know it was, you very carefully didn't call it a consciousness monitor, but it was like a sort of depth of anaesthesia monitor, so to see whether you could consistently measure how deeply underneath people went, because really up until relatively recently, you would rely on sort of the way that the patient, you know, the sort of patient's vital signs and maybe the way the patient sort of looked. But, of course, once you're paralysed, it's very hard to, you know, it's much harder to get signals. Mm. And also if your patient, you know, partly because of the drugs, can't remember what happened anyway, you're in this real quandary, apart from the fact that, you know, consciousness is completely subjective. So what do you do?
So we address it from a population perspective and an individual perspective. So we give doses of drugs that have been shown to be effective in most people, in most situations, and so we're pretty confident that we're giving them enough. And then secondly, we use all of the information that you've just told us, you know, blood pressure and whether they're moving and all that kind of thing, to work out if that matches up with if this person is a typical person or an atypical person. But the EEG or brainwave monitors that we use, we stick them on the forehead. It's like a kind of a Band-Aid thing on their forehead. The audience will now realise that measuring this front part of your brain is, you know, who knows whether that bit is the same as what's going on in the back bit or in the middle bit, or and whether that's reflecting the disruption of the networks that really matter or not. And the answer is it's not. So it's, you know, it helps, but it's not the panacea.
We've talked about memory formation, and I want to talk about pain. So I think the quote in the book, Kate, is from another anaesthetist, is if a tree falls in the forest and lands on your head, do you feel it? But I do want to talk about pain and under anaesthesia and memory of pain.
Mm. I was kind of really fascinated by this, and because I sort of feel like, you know, I walked into this whole conversation, you know, sort of a bit like, you know, the fool in the tarot or so. I'm just kind of like, oh, this looks interesting. And then I sort of just found myself getting deeper and deeper and deeper, and the whole pain thing really fascinated me, and I don't actually understand it. But, I was really interested in that whole question, and also, you know, the fact that actually, I mean, the thing about pain and the definition of pain is that pain is a combination of A, the messages, the sensory messages you're kind of receiving from your nerves, and also your conscious sort of clocking of that experience. So by definition, no, you can't feel pain under anaesthesia, but you can experience something called nociception, which is basically which is basically pain that you don't know about. So the conversation about unconscious pain is really interesting, and you know, and there's certainly been you know, sort of studies that show that it's not a good thing anyway, because it can be linked to chronic pain later on, but also. There's sort of questions, I think, about whether it actually pushes people towards consciousness.
Yeah, I'm interested in hearing, Kate, Leslie, is pain a symptom of pushing people towards consciousness? Is that how you'd describe it?
Well, so Kate's right that when you're under general anaesthesia, you don't have pain, because pain is the conscious experience of nociception, and nociception is, you know, the bits of your body that are telling your brain that there's danger or injury. And if you're having a very painful operation, you need more anaesthesia than if you're having a not very painful procedure. So, yes, so that's why sometimes people are aware when the surgery suddenly gets a whole lot more painful and stimulating. There's two reasons to treat pain well during the operation. One is that it reduces the amount of the anaesthetic that you need to give, which is great. But the other thing is that if you treat pain well while it's being created, then you've got a much better chance of not having pain afterwards. So we give, you know, most of us now give 4 or 5 different pain-killing drugs during the anaesthetic. We do nerve blocks and epidural blocks and that kind of thing to try and stop pain. And then there's a sort of ethical question about, you know, if you are offered the 100% safe drug that knocked you out, but you remembered the pain of the whole thing, you experienced the pain while it was going on and then didn't remember it afterwards, would you accept that drug? You know, and the answer is no.
No, well, they actually did a survey, the group of anaesthetists in England actually had a survey on that, because an American anaesthetist had suggested, he was being a bit sort of intemperate with his language, I think, but his argument was, well, look, really, actually, maybe in terms of measuring anaesthesia, what we don't necessarily need to... Maybe we should stop worrying about whether people are conscious or not. Maybe we should worry about whether they remember or not. And that argument was because, basically, you don't want to anaesthetise people too deeply because those drugs have other potential effects on the brain. So, but you know, there was a group of anaesthetists in, I think, Bristol, who immediately did a staff survey, sort of saying, OK, well, if you had the choice of being, you know, sort of, you know... Well, they asked various questions, but culminating in, you know, that very question, would that be acceptable? And, like, 97% said no. And I thought, well, who are the 3% who said yes?
Not from Bristol, perhaps. Before we go to audience questions, I do... I promised Kate Leslie that we would talk about the structure of the book. And, I mean, it is also another question about pain for you, Kate Cole-Adams. Yes.
Yeah.
Because this was a wrestle. You wrestled as you mapped and learned. And I wondered if you could talk about that process. Because this, I've been at pains to describe exactly what this is. I mean, this is a kind of personal topology to some extent.
And when did it change from a work of journalism to a memoir or a hybrid of various genres?
That was probably in about the sort of over the decade between when I first met you and when I did. I mean, I was fascinated in this topic, but when I set out, I actually, because my background is in journalism, and I just finished this novel, which was really hard work, and I thought, I'm going to do nonfiction because I get that, and that's going to be really straightforward. So, I really, really struggled with this book, partly because of that struggle, I think, and I think journalists do struggle with that, and particularly we're taught to think and write in a certain way, and the idea of kind of injecting, the sort of I in any significant way is kind of upsetting.
Verboten.
Yeah, well, you know, it's sort of more allowed, but it's so hard to get the balance between kind of being present and being a complete wanker. And I spent a lot of, you know, I probably spent, if you looked at all the years I spent on this book, I probably spent, you know, one entire year wondering and worrying about that particular line. But I think for me the reality was that this book just really took over, and this book started announcing to me the sort of book it was going to become. And it became very much, you know, the parts of me that were trying to be in control and that was trying to be, you know, my conscious self was just constantly, and for years was embattled with my kind of unconscious self. And, you know, and the result of that was a combination of kind of depression and anxiety and really bad dreams. Some of them about anaesthesia. So, you know, in the end, I kind of really... I was sort of forced to accept, and I do, you know, I mean, this is a book about anaesthesia, but for me, the real decision about moving away from it being a straight sort of reportage book was, to me, that was much less interesting than trying to do a book that actually... I mean, the way it's structured, I wanted to create something that included in the structure both the conscious parts of ourselves and the unconscious parts of ourselves, and that also felt like the way a mind works. And so that kind of idea of sort of moving around between things and bouncing between different kind of aspects, A, really appealed to me, and B, it was really the only way this book was ever going to get finished, and I had to finish it because otherwise I would be like 90 and I'd still be doing it. So, yeah.
Would you like to read just a little section?
Yeah, sure. Have we got a minute?
We've got a minute, yeah. Let's do it.
All right. All right. Well, I've got various bits, but I might just read that bit that we mentioned before. Okay, this section is in the middle of a kind of a part of the narrative where I take myself to this anaesthesia conference in Hull, and it was very early in the research, and I really had no idea why I was sort of fascinated, but what am I doing here? And when I sort of got there, I basically ended a fairly extended, I mean, what I look at now and go, well, it was a fairly extended panic attack, but back then I didn't really know what was going on at all. So this is sort of halfway through the section where I write about that. I'm afraid of dying. I know this is unremarkable, but I think about it a lot. How can someone be here and then not? How can that ever make sense? It does my head in. When I was a child, I'd try to lie awake and wait for the moment, the actual instant, when I would cross from my waking self to that other. I think I believed that if I could only capture the intruder, sleep, I would be able to prevent it running off with my thoughts and all the other things that made me feel like me. My parents, who both started practicing early with the deaths of their own parents, have often seemed to me pragmatic to the point of fatalism about mortality. I grew up assuming they'd be dead or close to it by the time I hit my 20s. I worried when they went out that they would not return. I imagined car crashes and roof collapses and absence and loss. Anaesthesia is not, I understand, the same as death, although sometimes it is. It was for Michael Jackson. But it feels like death. Not so much the experience, although who knows, but the fact of it, the extinction of self, that worries me. So does the idea of being paralysed and the idea of being buried alive. Not, of course, that your doctor is going to bury you alive, but to be paralysed and unheard. And, of course, the idea, not just the idea, the certainty of losing control. There was a stage in my life, probably a too long one, when I liked to lose control. I liked drinking, I liked roller coasters, and I liked getting on aeroplanes, buckling up and relinquishing myself to the ministrations and constraints, the hot face towel, the regimented geometric meals, the little screen halfway up the aisle showing obscure or yet-to-be-released films. This was the olden days. The destination set and irrevocable. On a plane, I would enter a kind of trance, a perfect passivity born of the almost complete absence of options, so that each little choice seemed delightful. Chicken or beef, red or white. All the while hurtling through a strangely unreal sky, day, night, day, perhaps towards some distant, more perfect version of myself. I think that was it. I loved it. Until one day I didn't. I was in my late 20s in a plane en route to France when I became aware of an unfamiliar unease that quickly coalesced into dread. Belted into my narrow seat in that inexplicable metal cylinder, what terrified me was not that the plane would plummet or explode or hit another plane, but that any second now, unless I could exercise an unthinkable degree of control, I would start to scream. I could feel my hands and feet twitching with the need to leap up. My throat shrank with the effort of staying silent. It seemed to last hours, though the worst of it was over by the time we stopped to refuel somewhere in the Middle East. There I accosted a Frenchman and begged for one of his cigarettes. He gave me two, which I smoked in succession, drawing the hot, grimy air deep into my lungs with gratitude and relief. I have no idea what I would have cried out if I'd risen to my feet in the plane and started to yell. But for some years after that, whenever I entered an airport, I would begin to feel the same sort of spiralling incapacity as now enveloped me in the anonymous hotel room in Hull. This is a special way of being afraid. No trick dispels, wrote poet Philip Larkin in his tart, sombre rumination on death, or Bard. Larkin spent most of his working life in the Bryn Mawr Jones Library at the University of Hull, where the conference was now being held. I don't know how many of the anaesthetists knew the poem. It wasn't mentioned in the conference material. No sight, no sound, no touch or taste or smell. nothing to think with, nothing to love or link with, the anaesthetic from which none come round.
Thank you so much, Kate. Those, that poetic mapping of the self, it runs right the way through the book for me, and paired with the science and the studies that you speak to are incredibly meaningful, I think. Let's turn to audience questions. We've got two ushers, one on either side, and just raise your hand if you have a question.
Hi, this is a question for Professor Kate. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the difference between being in a coma and being anaesthetised.
So comas can be drug-induced or not drug-induced. Drug-induced comas are in fact, general anaesthesia. So sometimes on the news you'll hear things like they've got Michael Schumacher in a drug-induced coma, and he's under general anaesthesia. And then there's comas which are due to brain injury. And they're not reversible in the same way that general anaesthetic comas are reversible. And they will only get better by a long process of recovery.
Hi. Just another question for Professor Kate. What is the current thinking about the link between anaesthesia triggering Alzheimer's disease?
This is a very interesting question, which I'm glad that you've raised. A lot of people fear losing their marbles when they have an anaesthetic. People in most of them of middle and young age need not worry at all. It's mainly a problem that afflicts the very young and the very elderly. And there's a lot of work going on at the moment in Melbourne about the effect of anaesthetics on babies and their development. But let's talk about the other end of life. So a number of things happen to older people when they have anaesthetics. They take longer to wear off, so that's the first thing. They don't tolerate the pain medicine as well as younger people, and that make them a bit dotty. So part of the early phase of what we call delirium in older people is drug-induced. And then there's a kind of... I say to the relatives of my extremely old patients, you know, your mother is going to lose a few of her marbles around the hospital, and she's probably not going to find all of them. Mm. And so... there are some effects of probably long-term effects of the anaesthetic that is work that's ongoing, and it's not been confirmed at all. But there's the effects of the surgery. So anaesthetists always blame the surgeon for all of the problems, and the surgeon blames the anaesthetist. But the stress of the surgery can be overwhelming for older people. And then another thing is that quite often people have been getting by at home by themselves, and then they come into hospital with some type of injury, and they're out of the closet. You know, they can't hide the fact that they've got a dementing problem, and everyone, their relatives and the doctors and everyone, starts to recognise that. So that can be blamed on the surgery and the anaesthetic, but it's actually just part of a long, ongoing dementing process. So there's stacks of research being done about this at the moment. It's one of our most active areas.
Mm-hmm. This is not really a question. I suppose it's more of a comment. As a child in the 40s and 50s, I had to have a number of anaesthetics and still remember the mask over your face where they dripped, I don't know, chloroform or something
hideous. Chloroform or ether.
Ether. Yeah. As a nurse in the 60s, we had patients who vomited intractably, you know, after every anaesthetic. Now, we have the luxury now for most of us that anaesthesia is so skilled in such an amazing science that, you know, you wake up and a couple of hours later you're not feeling too bad at all. It mightn't be perfect, but by God, it's a hell of a lot better than what it used to be.
Yeah, my father remembers having his tonsils out on the kitchen table in their country country home and under ether. And people never forget... they even can smell the ether when they drive past hospitals.
Mm. Yeah. Well, same with my father, who I think is here somewhere. It's clearly one of those memories that just stays. And
My father-in-law remembers going under ether as a young child, and he feels that he did have an awareness incident, and he's had flashbacks since. So yeah, that and the smell is just so. And I in the book you cover the fact that the auditory, the sounds are the things that go last when you're under. That they're the things that remain, and yet we've talked so much about the visions that people have and the dreaming that they do, and I find that really interesting, that whereas it's actually the sounds that are the things that are kind of remain.
Well, I mean, I suppose it's the same in the process of death as well, that, you know, and in coma, that you know, hearing... and I'm sure there's all sorts of reasons that I don't understand about how they works in the brain, but hearing is the last sense, is the most resilient sense in a sense.
I'm not sure about that. Okay. I mean, I don't
but
know.
But we think that's the case.
Kate, you in the book you talk about that dying, that process where that studies have shown that... studies have shown, I promised I wouldn't use that phrase, that the electric activity in the brain that's occurring, that it can sense sound. That do you remember the study that I'm kind of referring to?
No, I'm not. I can't remember the specific study, but I think one of the things that really, once I've kind of relinquished to this not being a sort of popular science book, one of the things that really fascinated me was transitional states and the sort of, you know, conscious to unconscious. But also then the kind of process of, you know, and realising it's not a switch, it's a process, and which may include a number of switches, but also looking at the process of death and wondering about that. And some anaesthetists have done some research on that. And, and there is one study in there towards, I'm not sure if this is one you mean, where it was a study on, this is the rats, is this?
Yeah,
so this is right at the end, and and they kind of realise that it's a lab rat story, and it's a bit sad, but various lab rats who were hooked up for some other study, but their brains were hooked up. A couple of them died overnight, and they realised in the morning when they looked at the brain waves that there'd been this enormous kind of burst of brain activity. Just after what would have been death. And so, you know, one of the kind of... And this book became a very personal book for me, and in the last stages of writing this book, my mum was in the process of she had cancer, and she was in the process of her dying and her eventual death. And so those kind of questions became increasingly important to me, I think, and that kind of sense of, well, who are we? And... what the hell, you know, what does that even mean that the brain goes kind of completely bonkers when you're meant to be dead? And this, when they look at it, it's sort of like super consciousness. I mean, the number of kind of connections, but it might not be super consciousness, it might just be bzzup. I don't know.
But I like the way it makes me think about how we talk to each other when we talk to each other, the fact that Kate Leslie talks to her patients throughout and that we talk to our family and loved ones as they're dying, and that's not a wasted kind of effort, that they potentially hear us.
And, for me, you know, as a non-medical professional, you know, the one takeout, I hate that word, I just said it. But anyway, for me, the idea of communication is really, really important. And so many of the stories I heard, even the ones that couldn't have been solved, would have been really helped by effective communication. And I think, as you say, Kate, actually, your guys are getting much, much better at that.
We hope so.
Yeah.
You described them as a kind of... guardian angels in the operating theatre, and I think that's true. All of your monitoring and talking, and it's important work.
That's the way we'd like to think about it, that, you know, you're not alone when you're not alone when you're under the anaesthetic.
Kate Leslie will now sing a song.
No, thank you.
We have run out of time, unfortunately. Kate Cole Adams will be signing books at the back of the room, and thank you both so much for going there, going under with me.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.